that we're, the class that I'm going to be offering today is, of course, I try to do it on the Parsha. Last week, I did it on the Haggadah. I try to do it on the Parsha. And of course, this week's Parsha is bumped to next week because the back end of Passover coincides with Shabbat. And therefore, we actually go back in the reading cycle that we would normally be in, which is the middle-ish beginning of Leviticus. And we jump back to the middle of Exodus, because of course, Passover is about Vehigadata, and you shall tell the story, right? Which is one of the commandments in the Torah, which is why we do the retelling at the Seder. What we wind up doing with the back end of Passover is during the intermediate days, we talk about the sacrifices. And at the back end, we start to tell kind of more of the story from when they get out of Egypt, when they are finally released after the 10th plague. So the beginning of Passover, we talk about the 10 plagues. The end of Passover, the liturgy is the crossing of the Red Sea. We're going to spend a little bit of time looking at just a few Hasidic texts at the beginning of a text that we read in services every single morning, right? And that is the Shirat Hayam, the Song of the Sea, right? The section of the Torah which contains the crossing of the Red Sea. And our Hasidic rabbis are really interested in issues of faith that come up in the verses that we are learning, because there's a bunch of stuff in there which kind of implies that the Jews have a greater degree of faith at the crossing of the Red Sea than they do at the end of the 10 plagues. And that's an interesting and strange question as to why that would be, right? If you witness God dishing out 10 wonders that result in you being freed from Pharaoh's grasp, and you make it to the Red Sea, shouldn't you have 100% faith in God? And the answer that the Torah gives us is no, they don't have 100% faith in God at that point. And so we're going to kind of ask why. So of course, in the Hasidic dimension, we're only interested in what that means for us, right? We're interested in the question of why the Israelites who left Egypt lacked faith after the 10 plagues. But the question kind of pivots to us, which is, why do we have faith? What causes faith? What does faith mean? And what are the intricate, specific, central details that are parts of our faith? I will warn you, the third text, you may not agree with at all. You may just find it too hyper-religious and too serious-minded, and that's fine. You know me. I bring you guys stuff. You are all critical readers who are allowed to read something and say, I dig this or I do not dig this. Okay, cool. All right, with that, we're going to share a screen. And here we go. We are looking at Exodus 14, verses 30 and 31. Those are the Hebrew texts that immediately precede the actual, what's called Shirat Hayam, the Az Yashir Moshe, Uvenei Yisrael, Ata Shira Hazad Adonai, Vayamru Lemor, that begins services. Almost every conservative and all Orthodox synagogues sing, or realistically, when they're in a hurry, mumble that part. But before we sing the actual Az Yashir Moshe Shirat Hayam, we mumble the final three verses of chapter 14. Okay, and the last two of those three verses is, or actually, no, I'm sorry. We mumble the two verses, and these are the two verses that we mumble. Vayosh Adonai b'yomahu et Yisrael miyad Mitzrayim v'yar Yisrael et Mitzrayim metosfat hayam. That's how it sounds in prayer. But when we mumble it in the trope, it sounds a little bit different. Thus God delivered Israel that day from the Egyptians. Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the shore of the sea. The next line is Vayar Yisrael et hayad hagdolah. So Vayar is Yoreh. The three-letter root there is Resh Aleph Hey. And Vayar is and they saw. Or actually, and it saw, and the it that's being referred to as is Israel. So instead of it being plural, it's singular to the nation. So the nation saw, the nation of Israel saw the great hand, or here it's translated as the wondrous power, but literally it's Hayad HaGadolah, the strong or the great hand. Asher asa Adonai b'Mitzrayim, which God did in Egypt. Vayira'u ha'am et Adonai, and the people feared God. Vayaminu ba'Adonai, and they had faith in God. U'b'Moshe avdaho, and Moses, God's servant, right? So you can kind of see where this might be going in the future, which is they fear God and they believe in God. So those are interesting by themselves. And there's also the question that we're going to look at of the line before us says, and they delivered Israel, right? God delivers Israel. And then the next line we get, and the Israelites believed in God. Okay. And that's like, huh, they didn't believe until that moment. They'd seen 10 plagues and they didn't believe. So we're going to kind of pull those back a little bit and pull them apart a little bit and kind of think about what are the aspects of faith for the Israelites. But I think more importantly, what are the aspects of faith for us? Like, why do we believe in God? I'm a big believer in God for the basis of creation, right? When I see the natural world, especially at this beautiful springtime, I feel connection to the universe and to the creator of the universe, to the Bore. And those are usually the way I interact with the divine. But here we're in the holiday of Passover, and we're thinking a lot about freedom and deliverance, right? And so the question becomes, how does deliverance give me a greater sense of faith? Okay, with that, we're going to take a look at Rabbi Chaim of Tzanz, Rabbi Chaim Halberstam, who passed away and who left the world in 1876. The Tzanz are Hasidim are still around to this day as a notable Hasidic sect. I think they're primarily in Bnei Brak to this day. Okay, to Rabbi Chaim, and he's got a great story. To Rabbi Chaim of Tzanz came once a woman with a bitter soul. So I just wanted to give you the Hebrew of that in case you doubt me. Marat nefesh. So to be mar is like the Hebrew word maror, right? Something that's bitter. And nefesh, her soul. Now nefesh can kind of be very literal as soul, but sometimes it's used more euphemistically in Hebrew as just like in their person, right? She was bitter. Like she was having a rough go of it, right? Ushfachat lefanav et siach liba. Very interesting. And she poured before him, the rabbi, et siach liba, the dialogue, the story of her heart. I translated it here as she poured out her heart before him. Umetzukat nafsha, right? With what distressed her soul. Very interesting. The other thing that's notable here, I think, is twofold. One, it's a woman. Interesting. And two, we don't know what's bothering her specifically. We don't get her tsuris specifically. We just know that she's having a rough go of it, which I think is really notable. I think it's really lovely that we're just talking about a person who struggles, because I think that personifies her in a way that we can all relate to, right? It's not about whatever is specifically bothering her, and we don't get the privilege at that point as the semi-unknowledgeable reader of saying to ourselves, right, oh, her situation wasn't so bad, or alternatively, oh, what a terrible situation. That's much worse than anything I go through. We just find out she has tsuris, and now that means, I think, as a reader, we get to relate to her tsuris, because we can say her tsuris are like mine. Or maybe hers are worse, or maybe hers are better. I don't know. Rabbi Chaim comforted her and said to her, I think it's interesting, it says comforted. You'll see that it doesn't seem like he's successful. Comforted her and said to her, be strong. It's really strengthen yourself. The Hebrew is tit chazaki. In your faith, and God will deliver you. Vayoshiacha. So it's the same Hebrew root, vayosha. She answered the rabbi, Holy Rabbi, I am but a simple woman, very humble, right? But in my siddur, from which I pray every day, it is written, and God delivered, Vayosha Adonai b'yom ha'hu, and afterwards, and they had faith in God. So the Hebrew for that is, Vayaminu Badonai, Moshe Avdo, which is the second line that we read up above. So line one says, and God delivered, and the second line says, and they had faith in God. Yes, yes, answered Rabbi Chaim, in great reverence. And he returned to this many times. So this is a great text because our supplicant, right, the woman who comes to the rabbi, comes seeking solace, seeking advice, seeking help. And the rabbi says, oh, you know, just buck up, lady. It's going to be okay. And her reply is, Rabbi, I'm kind of a simpleton here, but it says that God delivers. And afterwards, it says God has faith. I think the implication here is the woman is saying, I have not been delivered, and it is affecting my faith in God. And Rabbi Chaim of Tanz's reply is, yeah. And that's it, right? He's like, wow, good point, right? That's my reading of this text. And at the end, it said, and he returned to this many times. My interpretation of that is that he reflected on this moment that this woman who was in serious tsuris taught him with everybody else he met in life, right? He kind of changed the way he addressed and behaved with people because this woman taught him a lesson, right? That she didn't feel delivered, and so she lacked emunah, and that was difficult for her. So when the rabbi says, have faith and God will deliver you, she says, no, God's supposed to deliver me and then I have faith. I think this is a really interesting text and a really strange one on some level, because it's almost counterintuitive to what you would expect the Hasidic rabbis to teach, which is probably why I like it so much, right? You would expect a Hasidic rabbi to say exactly what Chaim of Tzanz says, which is, oh, buck up, lady, it's all gonna be good. And this lady says, narishkeit, poppycosh, balderdash, right? That doesn't work for me. I can't roll with this. And it doesn't work. And he goes, you're right, right? Like, maybe you will need to experience the deliverance before you can experience the faith. And I think that that's really valuable for us to be able to kind of reflect on and sit back and say, like, sometimes I ain't feeling it, right? Sometimes I feel bereft of God and I am lonely and I am sad and something shitty has happened to me and I am not feeling the divine presence. And this text kind of implies, like, that's okay, right? Like, if you can, but you might want to hold out, right? You might want to hold out for hope of deliverance, that it's there is hopefully something around the bend that will be better, right? I think one of the central notions of deliverance within the Jewish context here is that we may not be saved, we may not be delivered, we may not be redeemed, to translate the word Yoshia in a few different iterations, but that doesn't mean that we're not going to be imminently, right? You probably all know this, we talked about it last week, right? The reason we sing Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim and the reason we open the door for Eliyahu at the end of the Seder is because we think the Mashiach, the Messiah, is imminent, right? Like that if we just believe that this year will be the year that hunger, poverty, starvation, war, famine, hatred, illness, right? All the crappy things that we experience in the modern world, that they'll all go away. They don't magically go away, but we keep hoping that they will. And if we hang in there, eventually we look out over the horizon and we imagine that something better is there. We work for it also, which you've heard me talk about many, many times. Okay, any comments on this text before we go? Go ahead, Phil.
Hey guys, first of all, this is my mother, Judy, who's sitting in. We got to have some Passover together. But it seems to me like it's incomplete in a sense, and that like I'm expecting for him to say yes, yes, but in verse blank, 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 it doesn't it say that what you should, you know, have faith and God will deliver you? Because I, you know, I just imagine there's something that you could easily come back with. So the fact that he just goes, yeah, it is, it's weird. It is, yeah, it feels incomplete to me. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, it's a really interesting one. Tshuva zot mipi isha pshuta. I actually didn't translate it very well. Like this simple answer from this simple woman was for Rabbi Chaim meshubach meod. It was, I don't know, meshubach meod, like greatly praiseworthy would be a better translation. Like, but you're right that like there feels like he should kind of seal it all with a kiss and say like, I've got a better text for you, but he doesn't. And that's, I think, why I like this one so much. Go ahead, Tanya.
Well, you know, I often think about the psalmist David. Well, that came to my mind when the woman was crying out, because that's what a lot of the psalms is about. It's about David crying out for deliverance, you know, because he had all these enemies, Saul was chasing him. But whether or not he felt God, he was often bereaved and he felt alone, that didn't negate that he was still present. And I think a lot of times as human beings, we rely on what we feel. And you know, I've been taught too that sometimes God will hide himself. You know, that woman, she said she cried out every day. And you know, God is really good at playing hide and seek. You'll have to look for him sometimes.
Well said. And I think, that's a thing we've definitely talked about in this class, right? That God plays hide and seek. We talked about it when we got to Purim and Esther, which was the last holiday. We talk about it at Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, that sometimes we feel bereft of God, that we feel that God is not present for us, and that we are kind of alone in the universe, kind of making our way. Like you guys know me, I'm a big existentialist, and you know, existentialism is, as a philosophy, the system of working through woe and misery, right? Like that like God places us in the universe without any guide, and we have to kind of make our way and struggle. And it feels that way. The Psalms, as Tanya brings up, kind of come back at this. I think one of the cool things about this text that I think is best for me as a rabbi is the ability to reflect on the fact that the congregant, the layperson, tells the rabbi the answer. And the rabbi goes forth with that answer for the rest of their life. I'm still a young rabbi, and I am still learning that I am stupid, and I do not know the answer to everything, and that I need to learn from the experience of other human beings because it informs me. I think this class is usually extremely valuable in that for me, that as much as I bring Hasidic texts to you guys from hundreds of years ago, you guys bring life experience to me as to whether a text rings true. You know, if I teach three texts in this class and one of them, everybody in the class goes, no, I do not like that. That does not, Paula loves to say that, right? And Marilyn, when she's here, you know, that text is either likely to not make it in my book or not get taught again, or I'll find a new and different way to teach it. Or I'll tell other people when I teach that class. Like I remember a couple of years ago, I taught this text and nobody liked it. And I think that's really valuable to kind of reflect on. Judy, go ahead.
So what's interesting about this is that what the theme is, the transactional nature. To me, it sounds like a transaction. If God gives me what I want, then I'm going to have faith in God. And I don't know that for many people that necessarily works. I think faith is something else entirely, at least to me. It's apprehending that God is there, and all the rest is nice addition, but it's the apprehension that God is close to me. The Ein Sof is an interesting intellectual view of God, and I believe in that as well, but it's the still small voice that resonates with me. So there was a rabbi at my school. I went to the Academy for Jewish Religion, and we had all different people teaching. They came in and they taught, and he was a lovely, lovely man. And he went to speak to the head of our school because he was going to the funeral of an important rabbi, And in going there, I think he may have been by plane, so he was in an airport. That's not important. He injured himself. He injured himself, and that caused a crisis of faith. Here he was doing a mitzvah, and what happens to him? And I think I never forgot that little incident as it was related to me, because I don't really relate to that. Because I feel that we don't know God's ways, but I think that how this is wise is that in fact, in order for people to have faith, many people, they have to feel that God is in their corner in the sense that they're doing for them.
Yeah. Paul, in a second, I'll get to you, but my story, which I may have told you guys before, was one time when I was at the Jewish day school, one of our college counselor and our special needs director came to me one day. She was an observant Jewish woman, and she had a plastic bag and it was filled with mezuzah scrolls, like 9 or 10 mezuzah scrolls. She said, "Here, Rabbi, they're no good." And I nodded and I said, "Okay, Barbara." And Barbara had, unfortunately, her house had been broken into a couple of weeks earlier, and they had a whole bunch of stuff stolen. And a week later, both of their cars were stolen out of their garage. One of them never got returned, and the other one they found, it had been kind of like wrecked, and you know, some kids had taken it for a joyride and smeared, all sorts of food and stuff all over the back and put a dent in the front and stuff like that. And she believed she was cursed, right? And this is to your point, Judy, about what I think you said it, and I may have rephrased it slightly in your own words, which was the transactional nature of belief, that a lot of us, a lot of human beings in general, are, Jews in foxholes, to kind of belabor the metaphor, right? We have a transactional nature of belief, which is based in whether God is doing good for us at this moment. And when things are really bad, we call out to God. Or when things are going bad, to your story, Judy, we think, "I'm doing a mitzvah. Why would God do a bad thing for me?" Now, we all know, because we're all very knowledgeable, that the Talmud has already kind of addressed this issue and said, like, what, we don't understand why God does the things God does. I'll cop to the fact that I have my own aspect transactional nature of belief in God, right? I have kind of a Hegelian sense of awe for the world. And so when I see a beautiful tree or a good cup of coffee in the morning or a beautiful snowy day, I feel God's presence in the beauty of nature and creation. And that for me is the transactional nature of belief. I feel God's presence in that moment. But to Judy's point, which is a really good one, perhaps I should not be so transactional, that I should believe in a higher power, a thing that is larger than myself, not because of the cool stuff that I experience from that higher power, but because simply I believe. And that's it. And that's the thing we're going to get into with the second and third text a little bit. Okay, Paula, go ahead.
I guess it's a matter of whether do you believe, is your love and your belief in God conditional or unconditional? To me, faith is unconditional. My belief in God is unconditional. Whether something good or bad or indifferent happens to me, it has nothing to do with shaking that faith. You can be transactional and see the beautiful tree and the snow and whatever, but your belief is still unconditional. No matter what God dumps on you, you're still going to believe. And it's like the way I've raised my kids. I love you no matter what you do. I don't like what you did, but I still love you. And it's not a conditional thing. It's not, "I'm going to believe in you if you part the Red Sea and get rid of these Egyptians." It's like, "I'm going to believe in you anyway, even though you did this big thing. Thank you. And if you do more, it's wonderful, but I still believe."
Yeah. I think you say it in a very rock steady way. But I think we also have to acknowledge that some people are not as rock steady in their faith, that like when they get knocked down, they question and they struggle.
Well, then do they really believe?
Do they? Is your question? Yes.
Do they really believe, or is the belief conditional? I'll love you, I'll believe you, but you have to keep proving it to me over and over again.
That's really well said. It's almost as if you're kind of reflecting on the like a teenage or even an adolescent, a pre-adolescent intellectual belief in God that we expect that a person will develop through time. But I want to kind of go back at one step and just say one thing, which is, you know, Judaism's not a religion fundamentally founded on belief as one of our core values, right? If a person wavers in their belief in God intellectually and expresses doubt to their friends and says like, I don't know, man, maybe the universe was randomly generated. You know, maybe the Big Bang was just this happy little accident, right? I don't understand it. And that's, it's okay to believe that, right? It's actually completely permitted. The areas that we get into as Jews that are more problematic is when a person casts off their faith and the actions which go with that faith, right? The person who is oppressing their neighbor, buying a Maserati, not giving tzedakah, and eating, baby back ribs all at the same time. Those are the areas in which a crisis of faith is more problematic. When a person's crisis of faith results in causing pain for others and extreme selfishness towards themselves. So yep, you can
still believe that. You can do all those things and still have a core belief in God. You can believe in the Big Bang theory and say God created the Big Bang.
Right, right. That's true. But you can also say that the Big Bang means that there is no such thing as God, which I think a fair amount of scientists and science-minded individuals believe.
So. Maybe you're just looking for an excuse to not believe because your belief is not concrete. You can't see it and feel it all the time, and therefore you question it.
That's interesting. That's interesting. All right, go ahead, Tanya.
Well, you know what? I think about Job. You know, he was a righteous man and for his day, but he had all this crappy stuff happen to him. And I just remember one quote from the book of Job, and I don't know if I'm saying this right. You can correct me. He said, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. So he was a good person, and he had a lot of reasons not to believe in God. But even though with all the bad stuff, I think he made a decision. And I think sometimes believing is you make a decision to believe.
Tanya and Paula are big Job fans because Job is the unshakable man of faith, right? Job is beset by terrible experiences and he sees it through. And his friends are basically like, it's causative. You did something bad and that's why God is oppressing you. I wouldn't go that far, but I love the story of Job because the ultimate answer is kind of to the point that Judy said at the very beginning, which is we don't know what God's plan is. We don't understand God's nature. We just believe that there is a God that either has a plan or God doesn't per se have a plan in the micro for us. It's a little bit broader and a little bit larger. I'm not Job. Like I'm a little bit more shakable in my faith with regards to good and bad. You know, I believe in God, but I question God's motives for me and for other human beings when I see bad things happen more often. I don't understand God's ways. Job needs to be told at the end, you cannot understand my ways. Job seems to be believing throughout the story that there's a plan there. So one of those things that happens, I think, you know, especially after the shooting in Boulder and the shooting in Atlanta, you know, I get a front row view because those people, many of the people who were killed were Christians, and I get to see what either their pastors or what Christian pastors in general say about, you know, random senseless acts of violence that take people before their time, you know, and they kind of throw out all this theology that I don't believe, right? That God has a plan, you know, they were called home and stuff like that. And it doesn't resonate with me. And it does give me an opportunity to kind of reflect on my own faith in those moments. All right, let's move to the next text. We're going to pivot. We're going to continue on the same theme about faith, but we're going to move away from this topic of faith as a response to or in the face of suffering. So this next text is on the second line, Vayar Yisrael et Yad HaGedolah. And when Israel saw the wondrous power which God had wielded against the Egyptians, the people had yirah, awe or fear of God. So this one's really interesting. This text is all about, so both this text and the next one, which you may or may not like, are about the concept of yirah. And I would say this, a lot of you have expressed over the last 2 years that I've taught this class, and a lot of Jews in general have expressed the belief that the concept of yirah is not one that they hold or not one that they like. And I will warn you, and I'm going to wag my finger at all of you, that I think, I always think that when people struggle, including me, struggle with the concept of yirah, it's because they are translating the word too literally, and they are struggling with the fact that the word doesn't necessarily get narrowed down to just the one translation of the word yirah. It's a broader philosophical concept, which is core to both the Hasidic and the Musar understandings of the world. If at the end of this class you still hate the idea of yirah, I am fine with that, right? Like, you guys get to be judge, jury, and executioner for Rabbi Goodman's theological concepts. That doesn't mean, however, that at the end of this class, you necessarily have a full and complete understanding of the concept of yirah. Now, what am I, let's translate the word yirah. Yirah, yud, resh, aleph, is the root of the word means fear, but it is also translated as awe. So when you see a beautiful mountain, when you see a majestic ocean, that is yirah. You are having a sense of awe, right? In Hebrew, there is no separating the words for fear and awe, right? To be dumbstruck by something amazing is to have yirah. So whether that is terror or whether that is wonder, whether that is feeling a majestic sense of amazement, or a terrible fear in the pit of your stomach, it's the same thing in Hebrew, right? Which makes a lot of sense. When you stand at the edge of the Grand Canyon, you should have both kinds of yirah. You should be amazed that the divine created this chasm as large as it is, and you should also be afraid of falling in. When you stand near a volcano, you should be blown away, no pun intended, by the amazing release of magma from the core of the earth. And also, you should not get too close because it'll boing you bubbla, right? If you haven't seen that video of the recent eruption in Iceland, you should, because someone flew a drone over it and it's amazing. It's just back to the concept of yirah. But the question of like, I of course brought up natural world phenomena because that's the way I experience the world. But in abeyance, in absence of natural world phenomenon, what is the concept of yirah? How do we achieve it? And what happens when we ain't feeling it? So that's what these two texts will do. I'll read both texts and then we'll kind of comment at the end. And one last thing before we read the text, this is getting again back to this question that our rabbis have of, wait, the people saw the 10 plagues and weren't blown away, but now they see the splitting of the sea and they are blown away. They do have yirah for God. What's up with that? Okay. When Israel saw the wondrous power which God had wielded against the Egyptians, the people had yirah, which I translate as both awe and fear, for God. And now the rest of this quote is from Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Kotsk, one of our favorite guys. Okay. In the midst of the 10 plagues, there were Jews that had doubts, lest it was just happenstance that each of the things took place. Shema Rak Yad Hamikra. Like, you know, it just happened. I translated it as just happenstance. However, they eventually arrived at this quote from the second verse, and the people feared God. Thus, they were imbued with a higher state of yirah, for they knew that all of it came from heaven. One spark of yirat shemayim, which weighed equal to all of the wonders. So Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Kotz's problem here is, wait, The people, we don't describe the people as having yirah for God until the splitting of the sea. What was going on with the first 10 plagues, right? They saw God turn the waters of the Nile to blood. They saw God bring a plague of frogs. They saw God kill the firstborn of all of the Egyptians. And they didn't have yirah? And the answer is, well, sort of, right? Menachem Mendel saying, like, they had little yirah, but they didn't have a higher, a yirat haromemot, right? A higher state of yirah. They have now, and this is a very interesting word, a nitzutz echad shel yirat shemaim, shakul keneged kol hamoftim. They were imbued with a spark of yirah, which is equal to all the moftim. And I'm wondering about the, no pun intended, with the word wondering. I'm wondering if the shakul keneged kol hamoftim is all 10 plagues, or whether this is all 10 plagues, plus the pillar of fire and the cloud and the manna and the water, right? There's 40 years of moftim that the Israelites are going to receive. And Menachem Mendel is throwing out here the possibility that what happened at the splitting of the sea and this moment in which the Torah tells us that they have yirah, that they have this sense of awe and fear for God, the nitzutz, the spark of it, is equal to all of the rest of the yirah that they experience in the rest of their lives, which is really neat. It gives us this moment at which the Israelites believe, right? And they believe because the sea is split for them. Why that is, what is so wondrous about this, I don't know. I could conjecture that maybe it's the moment of freedom, that maybe it was just a matter-of-fact description, that like this really was the moment at which they believed. I don't know. It's an interesting one, but that they had doubts till this moment and now they don't. Renee, you have a question or a comment? Go ahead.
Well, does it have something to do with the fact that the plagues were against other people? The plagues they watched here at the Red Sea, they were asked to do something. They were asked to believe that they could walk through that, the opening of the water. And could that be the difference between awe and fear?
That's really nice that the difference between faith and belief has to do with the actions that you take. One of the commentaries I read that I did not bring to you because I did not know what to do with it was there's this famous story of Nachshon, right? This guy who God says, walk into the water, and none of the people do. And Nachshon, it's a midrash, it's not in the Torah. Nachshon walks in to his ankles, to his knees, to his waist, to his chest, and it fills his mouth, and then the sea splits for him. There is this midrash, which is the opposite of the Nachshon story, and it appears in the midrash in the exact same place as the Nachshon story. And the story is the opposite, which is that God asks, tells the people, wade in the water, right? Get into the water. And the midrash goes like this. It says, and the 12 tribes fought with each other for who would have the opportunity to go into the water first. And so the Hasidic commentary that I read said, you know, how can these two both be true? And basically it does a kind of a cheap, in my humble opinion, sleight of hand, which says like, well, yes, they fought to get to the water first. And then when they do get to the water, no one wanted to go in. And I'm kind of like, all right, whatever. That doesn't do it for me. But I love the existence of a midrash that's the opposite of the Nachshon story, because I think we tell the Nachshon story all the time, right? The people wanted to go in, they wanted to take action. Nobody wanted to go in, nobody wanted to take action, and Nachshon had to be brave. But the alternate possibility is also a neat story, which is imagine that God tells you something, that the faith and the yirah for the people was so great that they fought over each other to be the first into the water, right? It's like our experience with the coronavirus vaccine. I don't know about you guys. You're hearing on the news both stories at the same time, right? I'm hearing stories that nobody can get an appointment now that they've opened it up in certain states. And I'm also hearing news stories about these people who say that they're not going to get it. And I'm like, okay, I mean, both are true. So this midrash could go both ways, right? That there were people who fought to get to the water's edge first, and there was also a real struggle to get into the water first. All right, let's read the last text before class ends and before I run out of battery. This is from one of my favorite guys. I warn you again, this is one of those texts where you may hate it and I don't care. So it's a good one. I think it's interesting anyways. This is by Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Salanter was the father of Musar in the modern era. Musar is the self-afflicting, self-ascetic school of Judaism. Salanter is also the expert in Shmirat HaLashon, of being cautious with your own speech, not speaking gossip, not slandering other people, not passing on dishonest information, or encouraging even other people, not even being present when other people speak ill of others. And he's very rooted in a lot of the things that Paul was talking about, which is the importance of your core of faith being rooted in God. The one piece that I think is objectionable here is he's a little bit tough on people who have a humanistic view of faith in God, meaning that their faith is somewhat conditional on relationships with other people being good. So Salanter says the following. The people feared God, and then he says later, and they had faith in God. The first condition of wholeness, of shlemut, is yirah, is this awe or fear. And one cannot intentionally fulfill the mitzvot between ben adam lechavero, between a person and their fellow, if they are based on principles of humanistic altruism alone. If they are not connected to faith in God and a pure yirat Hashem, a pure faith in God. So this is back to that kind of concept of, right, the person who believes in God because they see the goodness in their fellow human being, or human beings are doing good for them all the time. That's their faith in God. That, like, you know, all things are hunky-dory and we're taking care of each other, then I believe in God because God loves me and my neighbors are taking care of me, right? That's a shallow faith, according to Yisrael Salanter. Every logical and intellectual rationale of humanism is invalidated at that moment they are tried in real experiences, and they are shattered like the breaking of hard rock of desires and appetites. So here he's kind of continually challenging that a humanistic belief in goodness is shallow. And not only that, but also the core of faith, which makes use of yirah, is a central principle. So now he's hooking the idea of yirah, of awe, to the principle of faith, right? A person who has faith, who has emunah, without yirah, without fear or awe, and this means typically an understanding that God brings things down into the world which test us, that God challenges our faith, and sometimes we will go through hard times, right? That's kind of the principle of tsuris, that you're going to go through tsuris, and if you cast off your belief in God because the world is made too hard, right? Back to that Jobian principle that Tanya brought. If at the first sign of trouble you bolt and you can't handle it, then you don't really have faith in God. There is no stability or validity to faith without yirah, says Salanter. Thus it is written, the people feared the Lord, and then it says later, they had faith in God. Yirah, awe or fear, precedes emunah, faith. Without yirah, it is liable that emunah will become spoiled and be perverted by the inclinations of the breeze and one's desires and the receptions of various troubles. Only fear of God, which serves to guide in the direction of faith, will be channeled purely. I like that finish. And I think the reason that I like the finish is because for those of us who have a problem with yirah and maybe don't feel really comfortable with it, then it becomes aspirational. it becomes that the development of Yirah in our lives can be a process as opposed to a goal, right? I think Salanter is throwing out here that the challenge for us potentially from Salanter is a person who has an adolescent undeveloped belief in emunah, in faith in God, which is predicated or on something else, which is based in, you know, belief in creation or is transactional, to use Rabbi Judy's term before, is an undeveloped faith in God. But a person who has fear of God, which serves to guide in the direction of faith, will be channeled purely, right? I may not have a purely channeled sense of emunah right now, right? My emunah may be stunted because my sense of yirah, my sense of fear of heaven, isn't quite there yet. I'm not that advanced, but it might get there, right? If I develop my yirat shemayim, my fear and awe of God throughout my life by trying to reorient my belief in God, even despite moments in my life at which things are not great, or when I am challenged, when I feel like somebody done broke into my house and stole both my cars, and rather than saying my mezuzah scrolls don't work, Rabbi, I channel that and say, like, there's work to be done here, right? Like, maybe spiritually I need to develop myself and my own rationale for why things happen in order to have a more developed sense of the divine, right? Another one that's related in this kind of undeveloped sense of the divine is there are those that feel like, a fire that breaks out is because, you know, I wasn't properly religiously observant. I didn't put on my tefillin today, and that's why I got a flat tire, right? A classic of mine. And that's an adolescent belief in Yirat Shemaim. I need to have a more developed sense of why God works in the world, or an understanding that God works in ways, back to Job, God works in ways that I cannot ascertain, and that is okay, right? That God hides God's self at certain moments, and that's not necessarily related to my behavior or to what's going on in the world, that I need to develop my Yirat Shemayim in order to continue to develop my Emunah. All right, I'll take any final kind of questions, comments, sermons, counter sermons here. We're 8 minutes over the semi-arbitrary 75-minute class that I created in the first place. Tanya, did you have a post comment?
I just think sometimes God is so completely other and we have a finite comprehension of him. That, you know, sometimes when he doesn't fit into our paradigm, we doubt his existence or we even wonder. But I just think the human mind just doesn't even have the capability or the comprehension. And the reason we know what we know about him is because he has allowed us to get glimpses. We don't see. And I don't know if what I'm saying is making sense, but to me, he's so completely other. And we're always trying to reform him. And I think Phil said this once, we try to make him in our image. You know, he made us in his image, but we, the finite human beings made from dirt, are making him in our image. And we're putting him on the same level as this flesh and dirt that we inhabit on this planet.
Yeah, that's a brilliant thought. I'm glad we recorded that because I want you to hang on to that and just play it for your rabbinical school interview so that you can point out to them, like, you know, I belong here, right? Because that's a great rabbinic thought. One of the underlying ideas that you're kind of scratching at there is, when are we bending God's will and our understanding of God's will to suit what we need at the moment? And when are we guilty of failing to recognize that God acts in God's way, and it may not be a way that I can ascertain, nor might it be discernible as a thing that I'm meant to understand. And how can I reorient myself to accept the world as it is and just say, like, yo, this is how it is, and I don't quite get it. And I need to kind of slowly reorient myself to the mystery in order to kind of reflect on what it might mean for me. The other thing is like reflecting on hard times now as misunderstanding what can be, and that five or, you know, we all can look back on our lives and say, there was a thing that happened to me and I did not understand it at the time. And I look back 5 or 10 years from now and I have perspective on it that I did not have before. And then I feel better about, or that I regret more so, right? Like, I think, you know, we all experience that as well. I have things that I thought were fairly innocuous that I did, you know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago when I was young. And now I look back and I go, wow, I was a jerk. You know, that wasn't good at that point. You know, having perspective is valuable. All right. Other comments, questions? Great. Paula, go ahead. Last comment, and then we'll.
Maybe God did the Big Bang and is just sitting up there somewhere laughing at all of us as we screw up and try to figure everything out and make a mess.
Yeah, I think.
We're trying to figure out God. We're trying to figure out why everything happened. The technology, everything we've done, God is watching us.
Yeah.
And he's laughing because, boy, did we make a mess out of a whole lot of things. And he just has not created the big flood to start over again.
There are a lot of different theological kind of, takes. And one theological belief is to some degree, I always call it, I don't know why I came up with this, but the punter on the football team model of God, or the kicker on the football team, which is that the kicker kind of runs onto the field, kicks the ball, and then the other 10 guys on the field have to do the tackling, right? And generally, if you're relying on the kicker to tackle the guy with the ball, you done messed up, right? You got a problem. That God on some level is that, right? God kicks off the ball with creation, the Big Bang, creating the world the way we see it in our lives. And that is up to us, the other 10 guys in this metaphor, to make of the world what we will. We're not really responsible necessarily. God's not really responsible for all of the things that take place. That's a view of the divine that works very well, except when it doesn't. So, we'll leave it at that. All right, we're going to call it a day. I'll see you guys later. Stay dry out there and enjoy today's weather, because tomorrow's weather is supposed to be 34 degrees. So if you thought we were back to spring, we are not. I hope you guys have a great day.
Wonderful class, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Wonderful.